Yesterday, we didn't have enough time for a question, so today I'm going to say to you, if you have a question, just raise your hand. I'll take them as we go. I'm the Director of Licensing and Compliance for the Utah Division of Securities right now. My duties include supervising the staff of auditors and training them. I review all new licensees that come into this state, seeking to be an investment advisor, broker dealer, an agent, or a registered representative. Just to give you an idea of how big this industry is growing, the state of Utah for the year 2010, which ended July 1st, we currently have 1,641 broker-dealers licensed in the state. Keep in mind that this also includes firms outside of the state, but they have personnel that are soliciting our investors here in this state. We have 89,000 broker-dealer agents that are licensed, 156 investment advisors here in the state that qualify as a state registration because they have $25 million under management or less. Federal covered advisors, we have 3,577. So roughly we have licensees, almost 100,000 of them that are licensed to do business here in the state of Utah. We are going to be seeing one change. As a result of the Dodd-Frank bill that was passed July 15th, starting on January 1 of this year, they're moving the asset under management cap for the state of Utah and all other states from $25 million to $100 million. So basically, all of those that were registered with the SEC that were over $25 million, they're now coming down to the state level. So we will pick those up to $100 million under management. This is also going to require the division will pick up about 150 more firms that need to be audited. We are trying to hire additional personnel right now, and we're hoping that the legislature provides us with additional funding in this next session by which we can hire two more. Tough economy, the legislature's pretty tough with money. We'll see how that goes. If we have anyone here that is in this particular area, especially if you're federally covered under $100 million, the division will be doing an outreach program in early November, basically to tell you what changes are occurring, and there's a new ADV form that will be filled out that we will be using. That will be broadcast on our internet as well if you cannot make it.
Can I just ask, is that ADV form the same as what we have to comply with the SEC, the new requirements, or is the Utah going to have something a little bit different?
We're going to have an ADV that's comparable with what the SEC is doing right now. There may be a change in there on the custody issues. That may or may not take effect by this time, but...
So we're in the process of rewriting the ADB. Should we wait till we get the Utah requirements, or do you think?
Are you under $100 million? Mm-hmm. I would wait at least until we get the seminar going and attend that seminar, because even at this moment, we just got back from a meeting in Washington, D.C., the NASA group, and believe it or not, they're still haggling about certain little issues that should be in the ADV, etc. So I would recommend you hold off about a month. Okay. Well, if I could just do a quick poll in here. Actually, I'd like to do two quick polls. How many are from the securities industry in here? Oh, great. Even more than yesterday. How about the insurance industry? The rest of you. Good. One other poll. How many of you think that you are overregulated in your industry? And there under-regulated or about where it ought to be? Okay, fair enough.
That depends on the regulation.
Pardon?
Kind of depends on the regulation. Some areas of regulation is a little heavy, and other areas might actually be a little light.
I could agree with you there. Yes?
You said you had 100,000 licensed individuals or companies in the state. How big is the department? How many auditors, investigators do you have?
How many do we have? I am embarrassed to tell you.
I figured you would be because you're not any different than any other state.
We're trying to get to where we're on an auditing schedule of every 5 years. We're miles away from that right now. And the reason being, well, let me answer your question first. I have 6 auditors right now. I could use 8 more. Right now, all of the time is spent working complaints, and that's why we're not getting out in the field like we should be doing. And with the Dodd-Frank bill sending us all of these other firms that we're going to have to be auditing, the federal government is not passing any money down to the state level to handle this additional workload. Right now, the industry looks pretty bleak. As far as ethics goes, we've had Enron, WorldCom, the banking crisis, and last but not least, we've had the Bernie Madoff situation. You guys are working in a very, very tough environment, an environment where ethics ethics have gone down the tube in many cases. There's a lot of good people out there that are working. They're working hard that do have ethics, but there are those who do not. I'm going to go into a couple of stories that are cases that we've worked in the division to give you an example there. Just a very, very brief history in the interest of time. Setting the standards for ethics in the financial arena basically started with the Investment Act of 1940. It's Rule 204A-1, and basically that rule required that IAs and BDs adopt a written code of ethics by which the customer should be protected and his interests become before anything else happens. The broker-dealer department was able to kind of get out of that a little bit, which I'll explain. They still have to have the ethics, but the problem is the only requirement regarding a fiduciary responsibility to the investors, the investment advisor is the only one that is required under statute to be a fiduciary, whereby the broker-dealer is only required to make sure that the investment is suitable. Part of the Dodd-Frank bill that is going through right now, it did pass July 15th, but one of the merits of that is the SEC is going to do a 6-month study regarding the fiduciary responsibility on broker-dealers. At the end of 6 months, they're going to decide whether or not rules need to be implemented requiring broker-dealers to have a fiduciary responsibility to their clients. I'm amazed. Shouldn't the client have always been first, the best interest of the client? It blows me away the fact that the broker-dealers fight this, and they have their reasons for fighting it. The main reason is when you put the best interest of your clients first, if they are required to meet the definition of a fiduciary responsibilities, they will then have to disclose the markup on securities that they sell to the retail accounts. They are fighting this tooth and nail. We'll see what happens there.
There are reasons that fiduciary duties to broker dealers it's not necessarily a good idea because it makes it a much more uneven playing field.
And I was prepared to go into that today, but we're close to time. But there are other issues. One of them is IPOs. If you put your client first, right now the price of an IPO is discussed between the broker-dealer and the issuer. If a fiduciary responsibility is put on the broker-dealer, then they have to include the client. They have to say, what's the best deal for the client? Well, the threat from the industry is, or from the broker-dealer industry, I should say, is if you tack a fiduciary responsibility onto us, we will no longer do IPOs to the retail clients. It'll all be done through private placements. I think it's just blowing smoke myself.
I've been on the broker-dealer side.
You are?
I said I've been. I'm not.
Okay.
I currently have to meet fiduciary duty requirements. But the problem is you'll get clients who don't tell you the exact truth. And they just know that they want to buy something. And somebody comes in and says they want to buy it, says they're qualified, you sell it to them. But if you have to do fiduciary duty, at what point do you stop asking questions before they walk out on you?
Right.
And you say, well, you know, I asked them all the reasonable questions, and, you know, they gave me good answers. Do I have a responsibility that I have to go verify this information? Do I have to do credit checks on them to verify these things?
What it would require is more consultation with your client throughout, more than like just once per year. It would be a continual consultation to find out what changes.
Every time there's a court case, that line moves again. And the security industry in particular, at the broker-dealer level, is a constant parade of people who felt, gee, if mm-hmm. I make this complaint, I can get my money back.
Right.
And the flip side of it is insurance fraud. And I don't know if you want to get into that. One of your counterparts came here a few years ago and talked about that side of things. It's a really difficult thing to put down a line and have everybody be happy with it.
It is.
Always going to be
a compromise. But my question to you would be, if it's required of an investment advisor, why should it not be required of a broker dealer?
That's the first question I ran up into when I qualified as an investment advisor. And I think the dealer side of it, IPOs and things like that, do have quite a bit to do with it. When you're dealing with making a market, it puts you at more risk.
Sure, absolutely.
You have multiple roles. The advantage the investment advisor has and the way they're able to hold out fiduciary responsibility is their responsibility is pretty much narrowed because they're usually individually managing an account or they're pooling the money to manage the account, and the goals are much more similar. You don't have competing goals. That's why they talk about Chinese fire rules and stuff like that between the side that does the investment analysis. And I see where you're going about saying you don't think it's going to stop broker-dealers from doing IPOs, because the way they'd have to do it is a Chinese firewall. That would be a minimum.
Right.
I have a feeling it'd be more involved.
Well, we'll see how the study goes in 6 months. I wouldn't look for it in 6 months. The SEC is a little on the slow side there, but
a little overwhelmed right now.
Yes.
What was it, Dodd-Frank? requires the writing of something like 150 to 200 new rules and regulations?
It does. It does.
And they need a certain amount of extra staff just to complete that. And come November, they're probably less likely to get the money for it.
I think it will be a lot longer than November myself. I think it's going to move very, very slowly.
Well, I'm saying come November, they're less likely to get money for it. So that's going to draw the process out a lot further.
Yes.
And that in itself, when you've got any rules and regulations that everybody's subject to but are not written yet, you've raised the risk for everybody, including enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a poor environment for everybody. That's an everybody loses situation, really. But that's kind of what we got with Dodd-Frank.
We do. Let's talk about what makes a very good rep, registered rep, an agent, brokerage firm, an IA. What makes them go bad, go to the dark side? What do you think the number one reason is?
Money.
You got it right there.
Greed.
Financial pressure, yeah.
Greed and money. The second reason is the fact that if they get away with it the first time, it was easy. So they do it a second time, but the scale increases. So when we talk about going to the dark side, what are they doing? Perhaps it might be front running. Front running is basically when you decide to unload your clients from their position in a particular security, and you know by the time you're through, you might drop that price down a little bit. So you go put your family in first and you put yourself in first. Then you start calling your clients. This is front running. That's just a minor example of going to the dark side. Another reason is the initial success does go to a higher scale. The more times you can get away with it, the easier it is to take advantage of your clients. And also, as you mentioned before, another reason that people go on the dark side is they receive such pressure from their firm. Their firm takes down a position in a stock, a large position, and they expect their reps to put it out to the public. Well, what if you don't believe in that particular product for your clients? In many cases, you're forced by the firm to take down your percentage and put it out to your clients. This is unethical behavior, not only on the agent, but certainly on the firm.
Yeah, it puts the individual agent in a no-win situation.
In many cases, that's true, but that's where you have to decide based on your ethics. Do I want to work for this firm or not? If they're going to cause me to engage in unethical behavior, is this really the firm for me?
The problem goes a little deeper than that, because you're then also leaving the clients with that firm, because they're going to insist that they're the property of the firm and that you can't take them with you.
Well, they're the property of the firm, but you can still contact that client after you leave, give them your reasons for leaving, and then it's their choice whether or not they continue on your book or whether or not they stay with that.
And what I've seen is some firms will retaliate when you say you're going to leave. They file a report terminating your time with the company.
Your U-5.
Yeah, when you do the U-5, they put on an adverse thing on there. And I've seen it happen a number of times. You leave a firm, they just slap a negative U-5 on you.
FINRA does investigate complaints like that from brokers that claim that the firm has put information on the CRD system that is not true, and firms can be sanctioned for it. But I agree with you, it does happen.
Typically it's stuff that can't be proved very well either way, and that's typically what they'll do.
Right.
I should say that's typically what they'll do. If a company decides to do that, that's typically what they'll do. we'll pick something that can't be proved either way.
Right.
I don't think ethics is ever an easy decision, but it's always the right decision.
That's exactly right. Let me give you an example that I had for me, and it's going to kind of go back to what you've been talking about. There's a lot of unethical people in our business, but do you know what? You learn real quick, and as a regulator, I learned very early in my career, the customer isn't always right. You know, brokers lie, reps lie, customers lie. They really do. In my job, I'm always looking at both sides. There is always two sides to a story. But very earlier in my career, in fact, it was within the first 2 years I was working for a brokerage firm. So I'm a young 20, 23, 24-year-old guy. I had been on disability for 5 years and was unable to work. And quite frankly, I'm in the state of financial embarrassment at that point. Well, I decided to become a broker. And quite frankly, the first 2 years, I literally starved to death. I'm sure the rest of you have the same story. Those first years are really tough trying to build yourself a book. Well, I had one really good customer that I kind of went out of my way for. Kept him up to date on all of his investments almost on a daily basis because he was a pretty good hitter for me. And I didn't have very many accounts to begin with. To make a long story short, he said to me, "You've done such a good job for me. I have an attorney friend here in town. I think I can talk him into letting you be his broker. He's a big hitter." Well, yes, he was a big hitter. So he was an attorney here in town, and he was involved in the IPO market. He was the legal counsel on a lot of IPOs, and I had heard of him, but anyway, I landed his account. I'm telling you, I was as happy as I possibly could be. This guy was a big hitter. I mean, his trades were large trades, and it really got me on my feet very shortly. And every day I would do things like, at the end of the day, his office was across the street from mine, so at the end of the day I'd get a closing quote sheet, run it over to him so he could see what the markets were doing for the day. That would be the markets that our firm made a market in. One day he calls me up and says, "Come over to my office." Boy, I ran. I don't walk. I mean, when he rang, you ran. So I went over to his office. It was a Friday afternoon. He says, "I got a stock. It's going to move. I want you to buy me X number of shares of Red Cliff Mining," or I can't even remember the name of the stock. It was a huge order. I mean, this was going to make my entire month. Thanked him, went back to the office. It's the end of the day, market's closed. So come Monday morning, he told me what he wanted to pay for it. Come Monday morning, word had got out when the market opened, and the stock took off like crazy. It was like a $7 stock, and it opened up at $10 or $11. Well, I didn't buy it. It would be unethical of me to have went in and bought it where he had given me a price to make the purchase. Got on the phone. I couldn't get a hold of him. I'm calling him every 20 minutes. Finally, at noon, he returns my phone call. And I said, "Reed, I haven't bought the stock yet. The price opened up higher than what you wanted to pay for it. All of it. He literally flipped out on the phone. He called me every name in the book. Told me he was going to sue me. And I mean, here I am already broke. I mean, there's nothing for you to come and get. But for a 25-year-old guy, 24, trying to get started in a business, this was tough news for me. Said he was going to sue me. Said I should have bought that stock on Friday. Well, in the 80s, the stock market, we didn't have an aftermarket. Trading ended at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, Utah time. I couldn't buy it. He said, if you were any kind of a broker, you would have called that trader at home and bought that stock after hours. Number one, that would have been unethical for me. It would have been unethical for the trader. We wouldn't have a timestamp ticket in there. To make a long story short, about 3 weeks later, my boss, the owner of the firm, calls me in the office and he said, Reed came in today and met with me. He's going to sue us for everything we've got. He says, tell me what happened. I told him, and he said, okay. So I gave him my story, and a couple weeks went by, and he called me back in the office again. He says, Dave, we're going to be sued. You're paying for it. You are going to pay for all of the losses he has incurred. I said, he doesn't have any losses. He said, well, he wants the money that he would have made on that stock had you have purchased it. And he said, you're going to pay for it. I said, I'm not. Everything I did was ethical. Everything was done just by the book, the way I was supposed to transact this business for this gentleman. So my boss says, I'll tell you what we'll do. The firm will pay half and you'll pay half. And I said, forget it. I will not pay it. Anyway, the firm ended up paying this guy money because they were afraid of getting sued. He was a high rolling attorney here in town. I swear for the next 8 years I lived in fear that I was going to receive a summons at any time, but nothing ever happened. But what I'm trying to say here is, yes, we need ethics in the industry, but there are also unethical people out there that we're dealing with. I can advise you to just cover yourself as much as you can with these people. There's nothing like getting documentation in order and additional documentation if you need be. If I might give one example, and this will hit home for some of the insurance people. I'm not a real fan of variable annuities. Oh, I see the smiles. The reason I'm not is because they are a big portion of the complaints that we receive at the division. They say, well, why are you receiving complaints? You don't have jurisdiction over variable annuities. We do. Number one, if you're going to recommend to someone to sell securities in order to buy an annuity, bingo, we have jurisdiction over you because you made a securities recommendation. If the subaccounts within the variable annuity contain securities, bingo again, we have jurisdiction over you. So we receive an awful lot of complaints on variable annuities. And part of those complaints, people say, I didn't get my free look, period. This really puts us in a spot. The firm will say, we delivered the contract. They had 30 days to look at it. But there's no proof they received the contract. This is what I'm running into. There are some states that require confirmation of delivery of the contract. Utah's not one of them. I think it's a shame. I wish the insurance industry would require that. What are we talking about for confirmation of delivery? For heck's sakes, put the contract and do certified mail or send a Federal Express. For $5 or $6, you can cover yourself. At least by doing that, if we get a complaint in and the customer said, I didn't receive that contract, I never got my free look, period. Get me my money back. So if I go to you as the salesperson, you say, well, wow, here's my delivery confirmation. You know what? We either have a forgetful or an unethical investor out there, one of the two. Yes?
Why variable annuities, not indexed annuities? Indexed annuities are even harder to understand. Why are they not under your jurisdiction?
They're not. They're still under the insurance. I do look for that to change slowly, but the indexed are still under their jurisdiction. I think mainly because it's a index in and of itself that's very well diversified, whereas in the sub-accounts, it may be individual securities that they're touting. I think they should be under our jurisdiction. They're not. So, a delivery confirmation. Very, very easy way to cover yourself. The other complaint we get, and it really comes a lot from the elderly, is I got sick, so I need some money out of my variable annuity. They're charging me all of these surrender fees now. I never knew there were surrender fees. Cover yourself. Joseph was in here yesterday, Greg. Your counterpart there, Joseph Bradley. His firm does this, and it's the first one I've heard of. Why can't you, as an agent or the firm, do a very simple one-page document with the purchaser of a variable annuity stating exactly what the charges are for the annuity? Exactly what the surrender fees are going to be, and have them sign it, and if you need to, notarize it, that they fully understand what the charges are for that annuity. I know you're going to tell me, well, it's in the contract, they should have read it. The size of those variable annuity contracts are multiple pages. And every single one of them is different. They don't read it, and if they did read it, they don't understand it. I'm just saying, cover yourself. Yes?
You're absolutely right about covering yourself. However, if you summarize any security product, the SEC doesn't like that. They want to approve everything is the risks are detailed and so forth. So the contracts are long for a legal and SEC reason. I would recommend instead highlighting what's in the contract so that you don't take away from the rest of it and letting them initial the different things because it says, yeah, they looked at it.
That's an excellent idea.
But the main problem is one, and I've got credit card things from all the changes this past year. I still haven't finished reading them. I read a lot of that stuff. That's your basic problem. The stuff's too long, and people have an attention span. It's a fraction of what needs to be covered. But if you can highlight some of the things and say, look, this is what the contract covers, and you highlight it, initial it, it shows that you took the time to go through it. And if they say, well, I didn't know what it was, this is, well, you were certainly shown where it was. There's your initials, and it was highlighted.
Right. You're absolutely right.
Stating all of the fees on a separate form along with the application.
You do that now?
The client has to sign on.
We have disclosure.
The explanation is disclosure saying how much it is, what their surrender period is, and how much of a percentage if they surrender early, what rider they're choosing, and how much the extra cost for those riders
right.
are.
That's
and
they fabulous.
Have to sign off, and then they have to read it over and approve it before it's even going to go to the company.
Great. What firm are you with?
Sage Point.
Okay.
Probably because of the AIG problems.
Oh boy, time is just flying. I have so many stories to tell you. We're not going to get to them, but let's talk about what not to do. What is not ethical in this industry? Sharing commissions with other people who are not unlicensed. I saw quite a bit of this when I was a broker.
You don't mean not unlicensed, you mean not licensed.
Not licensed, I'm sorry, yes. Like a broker or a registered rep may say, well, if you can get me some friends, some of your friends to open an account with me, I'll share their commissions with you for the first 6 months. Very unethical, dishonest, and it's illegal. Borrowing or lending money from a client. Unbelievable. But it happens. Sharing in the profits and losses with a client in his account. All of these are taken right out of the Utah Uniform Securities Act. I just nitpicked the very best ones. This isn't an inclusive list. Delay in delivery of securities or credit balances. We don't see too much of that. Failure to deliver a prospectus. Boy, there again. You know, an IPO, they buy an IPO, it goes bad. What's their first complaint?
The lawyer will tell them.
Oh, I didn't get a prospectus
right
before I made my purchase. Come on. Make them sign for it. Cover yourself. Deceptive advertising. Disclosure of conflicts of interest that you might have, particularly with an issuer. Unsuitable recommendations. Boy, that's a mouthful. Marking trade tickets as unsolicited when in fact they are solicited. Trading in a fictitious account. Making unsuitable recommendations. Is that unethical or what? A great percentage of the cases that we get involved with, their unsuitable recommendations. If I see a habit of this, these are the things that I have to weigh back and forth whether or not to suspend someone's license, revoke them, or just write out or bar them. In the last year, we've probably barred 15 local brokers here in this state from the securities industry. Discretionary trading, basically unauthorized trading, excessive trading, front running, selling away. Selling away is a big problem that we have, and it's coming both from the agents as well as registered representatives. You decide you're not making enough money. So an issuer gets a hold of you or you get a hold of them and you decide to sell a private placement and you don't tell your firm. Keep in mind your firm is responsible for all of the compliance that you're supposed to be under. When you go out and sell a private placement and get paid off to the side, you're cheating your broker-dealer. Pretty unethical. Even the problems that might be associated with selling of that private placement, your firm's responsible for your actions. A couple of other ones real quick. Misrepresentations and omissions. That's probably number one for us that we have. People lying about the investment. Or not telling them something about the investment that they know that would be pertinent information in order for them to make an informed investment decision. Insider trading and manipulating the markets. Go ahead, Greg.
That attorney was doing insider trading when he knew the stock was going to move that much?
Pardon?
The attorney you talked about, which broker.
Yes.
Did you ever suspect him of insider trading, having knowledge that he was acting?
It's hard. I think back in those days, this is the oil and gas boom days, there was a lot of insider trading going. I know he didn't have anything, he wasn't involved as an insider in this particular stock, but I also know that these groups of people run together. They make money off of each other's deals. Greg?
I was going to say, we're going to pass around the stamp, make sure you do track one, or ethics one is the one that 9% goes in. Please go ahead, Ken.
I'm going to hit on one more area. I think we got about 10 minutes pushing it. I think I'm going to come back to my favorite. Dealing with our senior citizens. We call it the invasion of the elderly in our office. Boy, I cannot overemphasize this subject for me and for everyone in our office. Is very close to our heart. We have so many complaints from the elderly that are coming in. They are being taken advantage of by a lot of unscrupulous people in this industry. But let me say again, a lot of times it appears they're being taken advantage of when they're really not. It's simply that the elderly do not understand. We discussed the annuity part. Just get back on my notes here, and I'll be right with you. Oh, I didn't explain my black eye. That was supposed to be at the very beginning. I have to do that.
That was an elderly complaint.
Yeah, it was. Actually, my boss told me to tell you it's the result of the last audit that I just went and did with my people. We got knocked around a little bit, but that's not true. Went out cunning, and anyway, got home and pulling the saddle out of the truck, and the strap got stuck, so I yanked on the saddle, and the old strap came loose, and there's a big belly buckle on the end of it. It caught me right underneath the eye there, but we'll go with the audit story. I think that sounds better. Right now, there are 40 million people here in the United States that are over 65 years old. From 2007 until the first quarter of 2009, the basic account with the market plunges down 25% during that time period. These elderly people, many of which depended on distributions and income coming from their funds, they have become the prime target here in Utah for abuse. We're seeing a lot of, we call them free lunch seminars. Perhaps once in a while you may see them in the paper where they'll offer to buy you free lunch. Just come and listen to our presentation. We're seeing a lot of abuse here. Right now, if we hear that there is a seminar, we do one of two things. We either call them up ahead of time, make sure they're licensed, make sure all the disclosure's there, and we want something sent to us describing what products are going to be selling, what they're going to be telling these people. If we have further suspicions, or if the flyer looks even more egregious, I send one of our examiners to that meeting. Boy, what a wake-up call for these guys.
Did examiners or the presenters?
Both, I should say. It's amazing what we learn, but a lot of these seminars that they're putting on are simply scare tactics to get people to sell what they currently own and get into the investment that the presenter wants them to get into. And more often than not, it's an annuity they're trying to get them into, some type of annuity.
Do your people you send out ever stop them if they hear them lying?
We haven't had to yet, but we will. They do not know we're there. But they are instructed that if they are completely out of line, then they need to confront them off to the side and shut the seminar down. We talked about the covering these people, but I had lots of stories for elderly people for you, which we don't have time to do, but we're down to 3 minutes. Do we have any other questions? If not, let me just say in conclusion, yeah, we got a rough market out there. There's a lot of unethical people. You can make a difference. Maybe you won't make as much money as unethical people do, but you're going to have clients that will trust you. These clients will bring you additional clients. And you know what? If you can go home at the end of the day and sleep at night and say, you know what? What I did today in my business, I feel good about, then your ethics are where they should be. And finally, I'd like to say to you, you are the ones that really see the crime going on. We get crime reported to us, but in your everyday job, if you have someone that comes to you, a new client or something, and they say, the reason I'm coming to you is because my other investment advisor took advantage of my situation, please report it to us. Help us so that we can help you keep your industry clean. Thank you very much.